I went back to my room and, with nothing better to do till my tray arrived, decided to take stock and see how many of my belongings had gone south while I was going west. Amazingly, except for my billfold with all my cash and credit cards, every last thing seemed to be there, including my passport. I called Tim, and he confirmed my suspicion that the billfold was under lock and key in the office, for safekeeping. The item of greatest interest was the tape recorder, which had a tape in it that had been run forward an hour or so. After I'd eaten and returned the tray, I rewound the tape and hit the play button, mentally crossing my fingers and holding my breath. The first second confirmed my hopes. It was a tape of Sheeran's speech at the theater on May 25th. I stopped the tape to consider the fact that if Heinz Teitel was right, these would be the last words I'd ever hear from her. The thought did me no good one way or another. I pushed the play button and listened. Following my usual practice of letting review material go by unrecorded, I had evidently turned the tape on in the middle of the speech. It's not easy to summarize what I felt on hearing what she had to say. She put it all together at last. I had no idea what the talk was officially called. I knew it could only be called the Great Remembering. This was it, the fulfillment of the promise. And it left me with only about a million questions. But there was one thing I finally understood beyond a shadow of a doubt, and that was why both Charles and Sheeran declined to formulate a defense against the charge of being the Antichrist. I was disappointed in myself that I'd been so dense about it that I'd failed to hear what they were telling me and what Father Lulfro was telling me. At any rate, I finally understood why, when I said that B seemed harmless, Father Lulfro's reply was, "That can't be right." Indeed, it wasn't right. I finally figured out why I can't get to sleep. I'm going to have to learn to think more like a fugitive. I'm too used to being passive and trusting. It took me 2 hours of tossing and turning to get the point that this is a potentially disastrous situation for me. I don't know why Father Lulfro failed to show up tonight, but I'm damn glad he didn't, because there couldn't possibly be a worse place for me to confront him. If he wanted to, he could lock me up here and throw away the key. I've got to get out of here right now and hope to intercept him on more favorable ground. Luckily, if there's a wing of this place that's high security, this isn't it. I think I could make my way out with nothing but the essentials: recorder, notebooks, tapes, and passport. But a 100-mile trip with nothing but lint in my pockets is not an appealing prospect. I should at least make a try at persuading Tim to liberate just one credit card from my billfold in the safe. Monday, June 3, somewhere over the Atlantic. So, that's that. Between now and Hamburg, I've got a lovely bunch of hours ahead of me in which to sleep and bring this journal up to date. And in a nice, roomy first-class seat, since no other was available on this flight. The Laurentians won't notice the difference, and surely they must expect to send off their apostates with a little Visa Golden handshake. Though it took the better part of 2 hours, Tim was persuadable. I may be dumb, but nobody ever said I didn't know how to make myself understood. I made a stab at getting him to throw in the keys to his car, but no, he wouldn't go that far. It took a couple more hours, but I did finally manage to hitch a ride. Once I got to an automatic teller machine, I was home free. I reached Father Lulfro's office at 11 o'clock in the morning, and by God, there he was, just where I'd left him almost a month ago. Something I hadn't exactly counted on since it was Sunday. He looked up at me from behind his desk, plainly astounded, and said, "You didn't have to do this. Jared, I was planning to come see you today." He actually didn't get it. He thought I'd jumped the wall out of mere impatience to be near him. "I'm here for a reckoning, Father Lulfro." He capped his pen and set it aside. Nice, well-thought-out moves.
"A reckoning, eh? You sound like the staunch hero of some turn-of-the-century melodrama."
"Different century," I said, sitting down, "but that's the idea."
"What is it you want reckoned?"
"I'll tell you what I remember. Then you can tell me the rest.
All right.
They said I might or might not eventually remember the explosion, but all I remember right now is a little flash. For a while, I thought it was something I dreamed, and maybe it is, but I don't think so. Do you know the setup in the theater?
Yes.
Your man in Radina laid it out for you.
Our man in Europe,
actually. This is the elderly person who introduced himself to me as Herr Reichmann?
That's right.
Why didn't you tell me you already had a man on the ground there?
It's always better if you think it's all up to you.
Then why did he phone me with instructions?
He got impatient. Professionals always get impatient with amateurs, you know that.
Why did you send me at all?
We sent you for exactly the reasons I gave you. Well, for almost exactly the reasons I gave you. Under his real name, Reichmann maintains perfectly respectable offices in Berlin, Prague, and Paris, and works on retainer for a dozen different firms and individuals, mostly in the U.S. He's a very useful, knowledgeable person, and 99% of the chores we give him are routine and innocuous. But when we asked him to look into Charles Adderley for us, he showed a side we hadn't seen before. His approach was, I can't make out what the blighter is saying, so why don't I just shoot him and be done with it? Whatever you may think of us after this dreadful experience, Jared, absolutely no one considered taking such advice. We had to send someone of our own to have a look at Adderley, and believe me, we very much wanted you to persuade us that he was harmless. And I failed to do that. It was out of your hands, really. He was condemned from his own mouth by the speeches you faxed to us.
And you actually authorized his assassination?
You said it very well, Jared. These days are still those days. Nothing's changed in the last 500 years, or the last 1,000, except that heretics can no longer be executed in public. I take all this as seriously as Pope Innocent III, who ordered up a crusade against the Albigenses. I take it all as serious as Pius V, who, when he was the Grand Inquisitor, personally instigated the massacre of thousands of Protestants in southern Italy. I take it all as serious as Thomas Aquinas, who said, if ordinary criminals may be justly put to death, then how much more may heretics be justly slain? For Thomas well knew that the murderer just shortens his neighbor's lives, whereas the heretic deprives them of salvation for all eternity. If you no longer understand the difference, or if it no longer matters to you, then I assume you've lost your faith.
You assume rightly, Father.
I'm afraid it's fallen to the modernist fallacy. I'm sorry to hear it.
Since you quoted me about these days still being those days, I assume the resourceful Herr Reichmann had the theater bugged.
Of course he did. It was an obvious thing to do. Adderley and his followers were just too incredibly trusting to survive for very long as subversives.
Yes, they were. So you knew they were recruiting me?
Yes. That was an unexpected bonus, and you handled it just right.
Except that I ended up recruited.
Yes. Except for that. You say you now remember the explosion.
I said I remember a little flash. I'm looking up out of a well at Herr Reichmann, who's looking down into the well at me. I think this was the stairwell at the theater.
That's right. Reichmann's story is that you blundered into him on the stairs moments before the bomb was to go off. Evidently, you assumed he was up to no good and wouldn't let him talk you into leaving the theater with him. And when you headed down the stairs to warn the others, he slugged you and left you to your fate. This was relatively lucky for you, since that iron staircase was the only structure that survived both the blast and the collapse of the roof.
There was nothing for it now but to ask the question I dreaded to ask. Did Reichmann tell you who was in the theater when it was destroyed?
He indicated that he got everyone. His exact words were, "The inner circle is gone."
I said, "Everyone else seems to think the theater was empty."
Father Lofra shrugged.
"Well, he missed one. Me."
He shook his head. Jared, you know I think highly of you, but you're not a charismatic firebrand.
I don't think being a firebrand has anything to do with it.
Again, he shrugged. You know, I couldn't figure out why B insisted on putting his entire schedule on hold while he dealt with me. It made even less sense after Charles's death. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, frankly, I don't. What is it that made less sense after Charles's death?
Why B insisted on spending so much time with me?
You're talking about the woman? Sharon?
Sheeran. Sheeran is B.
I thought Charles was B.
Charles was B. But so was Sheeran. Father Lulfer shook his massive head, shooing away a bothersome fly. B had to spend time with me so that even if worse came to worst, you could be told that you failed.
You're being far too elliptical for this old brain, Jared. If worse came to worst...
If you succeeded in killing both Charles and Sheeran.
If I succeeded in killing both Charles and Sheeran, then I still will have failed.
That's right. Because you didn't kill me. I'm not a charismatic firebrand, but that doesn't matter. I am B.
You are B? You really believe that?
It's not a matter of belief, Father.
I'm no longer what I was when I sat here 3.5 weeks ago, and you can't change me back to what I was. And you really think this matters, Jared? You really think you'll do something different now that you're B?
Oh, yes. There's no question about that. That's a certainty.
I'm not sure whether to scoff or to shudder, Jared. But if I had a gun in my desk, I'd take it out and shoot you dead, just to be on the safe side.
Would you really?
Yes, I would. Do you remember your friend Sheeran's last speech at the theater a week ago, or did you lose that along with the explosion?
I lost it, but I listened to a tape of it yesterday.
I didn't know that. At any rate, Reichman made a tape of it as well and played it for me on the phone. That was what...
He spread his hands wide in a gesture of helplessness. That was what sealed her fate, I suggested.
Yes, that's right. You see, she showed me more clearly than any advocate of ecumenism why we are a confraternity, Jared. We Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus. We've drawn ourselves up from the slime in which animism grovels so proudly. We represent what is highest, what is most upward-reaching, transcendental and sublime in mankind. What stands between the members of the confraternity are minor rifts. What stands between the confraternity and animism is a gulf as wide as the gulf between man and brute, spirit and matter.
I agree.
What will you do now?
I took the tape recorder out of my pocket and showed him that it was running. First, I'll find a safe place for this tape, Father. You called us too incredibly trusting to be conspirators, but you're pretty trusting yourself.
You're quite right, Jared. None of us has been trained to look at the world with suspicious eyes. But you won't turn it over to the police?
Certainly not. This is my safe conduct for at least as long as you're alive. Once the police have it, it's worthless for that purpose. He nodded.
Yes, you'll definitely want to find a very safe place for that.
Tuesday, June 4, Radenau. I'm installed in my old room at the hotel, and it feels rather eerie. I arrived early enough to place a display ad in the local paper, asking Sheeran or Michael to contact me. Naturally, the ad takers would accept nothing but real money, so tomorrow I'll have to see if this piece of magic plastic will actually produce more cash if inserted in the proper slot of some proper machine. Spending some time with the phone book, I managed to locate Frau Dr. Hartmann. She says my head should be cut off and thrown to the dogs, and torture wouldn't induce her to help me find either Michael or Sheeran if they were alive. Although, beyond prosecution, I am, in her opinion, guilty of their murder.
It's now 8 p.m., and I'm running on 3 cylinders. All I can do at this point is stay awake long enough to reset my biological clock to local time. In truth, I'm not exactly sure what I'm doing here. I suppose I'm here to prove that Herr Reichmann and Heinz Teitel are wrong. The inner circle is not gone. But I don't know how to go about it. I can't seriously expect city officials to dig up 1 million tons of rubble to prove something they already believe to be true. For the moment, I can't think of anything else useful to do. For the moment, I'm too jet-lagged to think at all.
Wednesday, June 5. This morning I found myself a money machine shoved in my plastic and learned that I'd ceased to exist. My card had been revoked and was fresh out of magic. I considered myself lucky. They could have been a day quicker, in which case the card wouldn't have passed muster at the hotel. I had a couple of choices. I could cash in my return plane ticket, or I could call home and ask my mother for a loan. I decided to cash in the plane ticket. Since the airline has no office in Radenau, I'd have to make a trip to Hamburg, which I decided to get out of the way. I made it back by 6 o'clock, looking forward to dinner, having missed lunch. As I was heading up to my room to rinse off, the clerk called me over to inform me that my card hadn't passed muster after all. I not only owed them for one day, I owed them for two, having missed today's checkout deadline by several hours. And of course, I was going to be a cash customer from now on if I wanted to stay past tomorrow morning. I shoved nearly half my resources across the counter and told him I'd think it over. Yeah. Saturday, June 8. So, at 11 Thursday morning, I joined the ranks of the homeless, my worldly goods in a plastic bag. I stopped at a cafe for a croissant and coffee while I wondered what to do with myself. I thought later I'd look for a cheap pension or maybe just a pleasant bench in the park. I went to the site of the theater. It was uncannily tidy, smartly fenced off to a height well over 2 meters. The buildings around it were perfectly unscathed. A demolition contractor could have demanded a bonus for a job done this neatly. The top of the iron spiral staircase was sticking up out of the rubble like the mast of a sinking schooner. The total experience wasn't inspirational or educational or anything. I stood there looking through the fence for about 5 minutes, then left. I spent the afternoon at the library on the phone talking to people with first names approximately Michael and last names approximately Dershinsky. I returned to the hotel to see if anyone had responded to my advertisement. No one had. I lingered over a pizza and a beer till it was quite dark. Then I started walking. This time I didn't know where I was going except in a general way. I have a pretty good sense of direction, but if I didn't find what I was looking for the first time out, so what? Time was one commodity I had plenty of. I walked and walked on feet already sore, and the sights and smells began to come back to me. As the social and economic atmosphere went down the scale, my spirits went up. I was heading into Radenau's grimiest neighborhood, the domain of factories, machine shops, brickyards, and warehouses, inhabited at this hour only by night watchmen and guard dogs. Before long, I spotted a small nondescript building just ahead, a sort of shed between a warehouse and a railroad yard, and I headed for it, hoping the door would open, and it did, giving me a double lungful of cigarette smoke, booze, and La Vie en Rose. It was Little Bohemia, and by God, it felt like home. I made my way to a table at the back, all the way to the back, against a wall solid with framed drawings and prints, not one of them straight, not one of them with a piece of glass that had been cleaned in 20 years. At eye level when I sat down was a faded sketch of Igor Stravinsky that appeared to be signed by Picasso. Elsewhere, it looked like nobody had moved since Charles and I had left 3 weeks before. When the waitress came over to see what I wanted, I asked her if her name was really Theda. "It really is," she said with a smile. "Are you drinking Lagavulin tonight?"
"I'm drinking your cheapest Rotgut, please, Theda," I told her politely.
but when it came a couple of minutes later, it tasted just like Lagavulin to me. Someone spoke at my elbow, and I looked up into a distantly familiar face. It was Albrecht, he of the giant intellect, the smirking 20-year-old Englishman who volunteered to dump me in a lake the first time I visited the sub-sub-sub-basement in the theater. I said, "What?" He said, sneering, "Are you B now?" Oddly, a great sudden hush fell upon the room. I felt it could hardly have been occasioned by Albrecht's question, but in fact every eye seemed to be on the two of us. I thought about his question some. I haven't had much experience with hostile people. Some priests do, and some don't, but I felt like I must at least know the ABCs of dealing with them. I said, "Why don't you sit down and tell me what's on your mind?" "Is the question too difficult for you?" "Yes, it is," I told him. With a triumph already in hand, he took a seat across from me. Knowing that everyone in the room was straining to hear, I raised my voice when I said, "Why do you ask me this question?" "You were being groomed, weren't you? Isn't that the word, groomed?" "Well, there certainly is such a word, but no one ever told me I was being groomed." He shrugged contemptuously. "I've abandoned the priesthood," I told him. This got a blink. When I spoke with the man who originally sent me here, Father Lulfra, I told him that killing B had been a wasted effort, because B is still here in the person of me. But I certainly don't think I'm ready to begin where Sheeran left off. Albrecht smirked. "Do you want to begin?" It began to seem to me that there was more than sardonicism behind Albrecht's smirk. It began to seem to me that he had something in mind, and I asked him what it was.
"B gave you something," Albrecht said. "You wouldn't expect me to know that, but I do."
"What do you mean by something?" Albrecht eyed me hostily. I said, "Yes, you're right. B gave me something."
"This thing would have been your test if Charles had lived. Sheeran understood this and tried to present it to you herself as a test, but you did what?"
"I'm not sure I know what you're talking about."
"I think you do. You refused the test."
The crowd in the little bohemia had by now divided in two. The larger half had decided that Albrecht and I were not very interesting after all, and had resumed their former conversations. The rest had clustered unabashedly round my table to witness Albrecht's examination of me. "Yes, I refused the test." With these words, I brought out the fossil ammonite that Charles had bought for me, and that Sheeran had used as the centerpiece of her bricolage. I set it in the pool of light under the candle on my table. Someone asked, "What's that thing?" I looked up at the stranger and said, "This is the something that Albrecht has been talking about, the test that was given to me and that I haven't managed to pass as yet. It's the fossil remains of a creature that may have lived as much as 400 million years ago. I've been assured that the past, the present, and the future are written in it. Think of it as a track in the dust. A track in the dust shows not only where the creature has been, but where it is and will be."
"Are you supposed to tell its future?"
someone asked from the shadows. "I'm not sure. Charles Adderley gave it to me, but was killed before he had a chance to explain why. Sheeran wanted me to smash it to pieces."
"Why?"
"I don't remember, to tell the truth."
"There's a message from B inside of it,"
someone suggested.
"Like a Chinese fortune cookie. That's why you have to smash it."
"There's no way to get a message inside," I explained stupidly. "It's solid rock."
"B could get a message inside."
Several unseen listeners expressed confident agreement with this opinion. Before I quite realized what was going on, a fossil-smashing party had been organized. I was uprooted from my table and hustled outdoors to stumble along in the center of a small drunken mob. I couldn't for the life of me figure out where we were going or why we were going anywhere at all. Others were leading, in search of some place or resource completely unimaginable by me. As suddenly as we began, we stopped and were promptly squashed and trampled by those who continued to blunder forward slapstick style. Someone ahead of me turned around, handed me a brick, and said,
"Here. Bring him over here."
someone else called out. A path opened up in front of me, and I was led forward to a brick stack as wide and high as a pool table.
"Go ahead," someone called out. "Let's see what's inside."
"There's nothing inside," I protested.
"Here, give it to me," another said. "I'll do it."
I clutched the fossil to my chest, and someone shoved me from behind.
"Go on,"
he said, in a voice no longer quite friendly. With the brick pile at my back, I turned to face them. "I'm not going to destroy this fossil," I said. They received this news as if it were a thunderclap. After a moment, someone at the back said in a puzzled tone,
"I thought Sheeran told him to smash it."
An imposingly tall man at the front said,
"Are you a coward?"
"No, I don't think so."
"Then why are you dithering? The fossil has no intrinsic value."
A woman at the back called out,
"He's not a coward in general, Gunther. He's just scared of this particular message."
Two in the crowd spoke at once. One said,
"That is the message."
The other said,
"What's he scared of?"
The tall man, called Gunther, stepped forward and spoke to me almost confidentially.
"It's not a thing you can just refuse to do, Jared. Charles gave you the fossil for a reason, and Sheeran said you'd have to smash it to find out what the reason was. So, you have to smash it. Otherwise, this period of your life will remain incomplete and inconclusive."
I knew he was right, and one way or another, I knew I was not going to leave that place with the fossil intact. So, with no more dithering, I set it on top of the bricks and smashed it. While I stood there befuddled, Gunther stepped forward, plucked a scrap of white paper from the rubble, and instantly balled it up in his fist. "Give me that," I cried.
"There's no way to get a message inside,"
he told me gravely, already walking away.
"It's solid rock."
The others laughed, and someone said,
"Don't pay any attention to him. He's just teasing. It's a trick, a sleight of hand. He's always pulling coins out of people's ears."
On hearing these words, Gunther tossed the ball of paper over his shoulder without a break in stride, and a woman sitting on a stack of bricks nearby darted forward to scoop it up as a souvenir. As suddenly as it began, the show was over and the crowd began straggling away. Only the woman who had retrieved the scrap of paper seemed prepared to stay. I felt like crying.
"You probably don't remember me," she said. "I was sitting next to Sheeran. That first night you came down to the cellar. Bonnie?"
"I remember you, Bonnie. I just didn't recognize you. You look older."
"I am older,"
she assured me in all seriousness. We stood there awkwardly through a long moment.
"Sheeran didn't hold out much hope for you."
"Not at first, anyway." Bonnie shrugged away my qualifying phrase.
"She thought you were too fixed."
I pondered the various meanings of that word, and evidently so did Bonnie, for she soon added a clarification.
"Too set in your ways."
I nodded.
"Like, for example, here you are, you've smashed the fossil to bits, and you're not even going to look at it."
I glanced at the mess on the bricks.
"Bonnie, it's just a bunch of crushed calcium carbonate." "Yeah, that's what she meant. That's just the kind of thing she'd expect you to say."
Well, goddamn, tonight was definitely my night to be abused and chivied about. With an exhausted sigh, I turned my attention to the debris beside me and sensed, rather than saw, Bonnie withdrawing a bit to give me some space.
What was I supposed to be seeing here,
if there was anything to be seen?
Or how was I supposed to be looking at it? What had Sheeran said about it?
I didn't think the memory was there at all. Then it suddenly leaped to mind. She said,
"I want to show you how to read the future."
Then she observed that Charles would have done it better, and that the point of the exercise needed to be more fully developed. She wanted to show me how to read the future. I closed my eyes and tried to listen for what she would say. What words would not surprise me coming from her mouth on this subject? Suddenly I heard her say, "The universe is all of a piece, Jared." It was so clear that I opened my eyes, half expecting to see her standing in front of me, but only Bonnie was there, sitting on a nearby stack of bricks and gazing up at the stars.
I close my eyes again, thinking, so, the universe is all of a piece. What does this tell me about anything? I let her speak. This tells you that the flight path of a goose over Scandinavia has something to do with a man dying in a hospital room in New Jersey. But it takes some figuring to find out what it is. This tells you that what's hidden inside a fossil 200 million years old has something to do with Jared Osborne. This, too, takes some figuring. This kind of figuring is the diviner's specialty, Jared, though anyone can learn to do it. The diviner is just a special tracker, a tracker of events and relations. Think about what you want right now. What are you looking for? That was easy. I'm looking for you. The universe is all of a piece, Jared. See what this fossil has to show you. Look at it in a way that demands to be shown what you want to know. I looked at it, demanding to be shown where to find Sheeran. And nearly fell over backward with illumination. If Bonnie hadn't been nearby, I think I would have yelped. As it was, my eyes flooded with tears, and my arms and legs began to tremble uncontrollably. Idiot, 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 the fossil debris said to me. Look closely, look closely, look anywhere you like. Do you see any Sheeran here? Any Sheeran at all here? Idiot, idiot. Sheeran is not to be found in the rubble. She isn't there. I waited a long, long time till I was sure I'd be able to walk without wobbling and to talk without sobbing. It must have taken 20 or 30 minutes, and I thought Bonnie might have left, but no, she was still there. After sweeping the rubble away with my hand, I walked over and told her I'd learned what the fossil had to tell me. She saw with a glance that this was the truth and graciously didn't press for details. I'm glad, she said. Then, do you want this? I said yes and held out my hand, and she dropped into it the little ball of paper that the conjurer Gunther had tossed over his shoulder. I've got to run, she said, sliding down off the pile of bricks. Do you need a ride back to your hotel? I didn't bother to explain that I was no longer being accommodated there. I just told her no. And thanks for making me face the fossil. I would have left it undone otherwise. Oh, you know what Sheeran always said? The universe is all of a piece. I never heard her say that with my own ears, Bonnie, but I'm glad to have heard it now. She hurried into the night, and I followed in her wake more slowly. At the first street lamp I came to, I paused and worked open the little ball of paper, just to make sure it was as blank as it was supposed to be. On it were penciled an even dozen words. Sheeran will live. Not forever, of course, but long enough for you. Half an hour later, I was beginning to regret turning down Bonnie's offer of a ride. I'd wanted to be alone, but now I was groaning for a chance to take my shoes off for 10 minutes. At this hour, there was nowhere to head but the park, and by the time I arrived, I had nothing in mind but stretching out on a bench and letting go. It was my first great lesson in homeless living. If you're going to go the park bench route, you'd better be ready to sleep like the dead. I was ready to do that when I crashed at 4 in the morning, but by 7 I only wished I was dead. I was now personally enlightened as to why bums will take booze over food any time. If somebody had stuck a bottle of screw top in my hand, they would have had a hell of a time getting it back. Around 8 I gave up the struggle and limped out in search of coffee, aspirin, and breakfast. I soaked up some caffeine, some painkiller, and as many carbohydrates as I could get into my system, and tried to figure out my next move. If my divination was to be trusted, I knew where Sheeran was not. She was not buried under a million tons of rubble at the site of the Schauspielhaus Wanfried. This didn't give me much, but it did give me a new place to start. The government building was there, it was open, and people were dragging around in the dull way people do in government buildings all over the world. The stairs down to the sub-basement were also still there, as was the middle-aged guardian at his desk who watched me approach with a suspicious squint. I wasn't interested in him. I was interested in the door to the bomb shelter, which was now very securely barricaded against access, with a pair of 2x4s screwed into place across it. I went over to inspect it, and within seconds was in possession of one of the great secrets of the universe. Getting an answer isn't so hard, provided you ask the right question. A name and a phone number had been neatly engraved in the wood of the top beam of the barricade. And it was the name and number I'd crossed the Atlantic to find. I almost didn't recognize Sheeran when she came out of Michael's charming little chalet in the woods 20-odd kilometers west of Radinau. The scarlet lupus butterfly across her face had faded to almost nothing, signaling a remarkable remission, however temporary. It was an awkward moment. Neither of us knew quite how to play it, or even quite how we wanted to play it. In the end, we made it a comradely hug that we pretended had to be gotten through so we could get down to the important business of bringing each other up to date. Driving me to the chalet, Michael had already told me most of it. My reconstruction of events at the theater was accurate enough. Thanks to the warning shouts I was able to deliver, Sheeran, Michael, Frau Hartmann, and Monica Teitel were halfway across the bomb shelter when the blast occurred. They produced a sensation when they emerged in a cloud of dust in the sub-basement of the adjacent government building, but there was enough confusion so that they were able to slip away without being detained at the scene. Everyone had agreed it was now time to run for cover and lie low for a while. The group was sharply divided by the news of my survival. For some, the fact that I hadn't died confirmed my guilt. For Sheeran and Michael, the fact that I almost died confirmed my innocence. The Teitels, convinced that Sheeran should be protected from her own bad judgment, had kept to themselves the fact that I'd called them from the States. Neither Bonnie nor Albrecht had been in the theater at the time of the explosion, and neither knew where Sheeran was, or even that she was alive. Neither Sheeran nor Michael had ever heard of a sleight-of-hand artist named Gunther. That brings this diary up to the present moment. The household is governed by a strange rule. We don't talk about what's next. Michael is single, the only offspring of fairly well-off parents, without dependents. We have no financial worries. It's too early to tell if Sheeran and I are moving toward anything more than we presently have. Her reserve is profound, as is her need to be independent and unpitied. Time will tell. I'm in no hurry. Undated, Michael's Villa. As I mentioned earlier, I entrusted to a friend the tape of my recent conversation with Father Lufra. I just got word from this friend that his apartment was broken into and ransacked 2 days ago, and the tape cassette is now gone. I'd urged him in the strongest possible terms to make a copy for safe deposit somewhere else, but of course he hadn't gotten around to it. My fault for not telling him it was a matter of life and death. My fault for not checking up on him. My fault for still being too trusting. Sheeran and I must now leave Michael to his woodsy retreat and go truly underground. He'll be safe enough when we're gone, because neither Father Lufra nor Herr Reichmann really understands what this is all about. I end as I began, wondering if there was ever a diarist who wasn't in fact writing for posterity, who didn't secretly hope that his or her oh-so-carefully hidden words would one day be found and cherished. In any case, if there are such self-effacing paragons, I'm not one of them. From the beginning, I knew I was writing with the possibility of being read by others. By you, in fact. From the first episode of my adventure, that initial conversation with Father Lufra, I guessed something was afoot that would eventually have to be shared with a wider audience than is found inside my head. to put it bluntly, though I tried to pretend otherwise, I knew I was making a record here, and I wouldn't have kept at it so diligently otherwise. Why am I breaking off at this point? Is it because the teachings of B are now complete and nothing more needs to be added? Hardly. The idea is laughable. As a culture, we've grown up with the obscuring lenses of the great forgetting glued to our eyes. From the beginning, our intellectual growth has been stunted and warped by this angel dust of amnesia. This isn't something that will be undone by any one author or by any 10 authors, nor will it be undone by any one teacher or by any 10 teachers. If it's undone, it will be undone by a whole new generation of authors and teachers, one of which is you. There's no one in reach of these words who is incapable, at the very least, of handing them to another and saying, "Here, read this." Or, "Here, listen to this." Parents, teach your children. Children, teach your parents. Teachers, teach your pupils. Pupils, teach your teachers. Vision is the river, and we who have been changed are the flood. I suppose people will ask you to summarize what it's all about. I offer you this, knowing how inadequate it is. The world will not be saved by old minds with new programs. If the world is saved, it will be saved by new minds with no programs. They won't like the sound of that, especially that last part. If it seems worth pursuing, remember the sticks in the river. Remember the Industrial Revolution, that great river of vision that needed not a single program to make it flow, even to the extent of engulfing the world. Who is B? Charles Adderley was B. Sheeran has said she's B. I've said I'm B. This is what's made us targets. I have to change Father Lufra's mind about this. That's what I'm doing here. I've lost the tape that was my safe conduct, and I can only replace it with you. Because believe me, if you've read these words, the damage is already done, and Father Lufra will know that. I'm not putting this very coherently. The fact is, I'm being rushed. Sheeran is packed, and Michael is waiting to take us to the airport in Hamburg, and I must leave this manuscript with him. That's settled. The steps that must be taken with it can't be taken by someone on the run, someone with no address or phone number. To resume, if we're not here, Michael will be safe, because Father Lufra thinks that Sheeran and I are B. What does it mean for me to say that I'm B? It doesn't mean I can match the knowledge or the abilities of Charles and Sheeran. It means I've been changed, fundamentally and permanently. It means I cannot be put back to what I was. That's why I'm B. I cannot be put back to what I was. Sheeran just stuck her head into the room to tell me that if we don't leave in the next 3 minutes, we'll miss our plane. So, in terrible haste, I've written the words, and they've found their way to you. I don't know how exactly. Michael says he has connections who know how to handle that part of it. I won't worry about that. The words have found their way to you, even if having read them or heard them, you hate them. Even if you hide them from your children and consign them to the flames, they've found their way to you. So it's already too late. Even if in the meantime Father Lufra tracks us down and sends his assassins to us, he'll be too late. Because of what you've read here, the contagion has been spread. You are B. This is Anthony Heald. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Story of B by Daniel Quinn. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Doug Tuck, abridgment by the author. Mix directed by Steve Gomer. Production copyright 1996. Phantom Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing. All rights reserved. The book The Story of B is available wherever Bantam books are sold.